Cast host. I'm here with Amira Virani of The Designed Life, and I'd like to have you tell us a little bit about that life and what has built the expertise that you're bringing to the market.
Well, first, thank you so much, Jeremy, for having me on your podcast. It's such a pleasure to be here. And I love to tell this story because The Designed Life is really exactly what it says. It's about you intentionally choosing how you're going to live and experience your life across the core foundational pillars of living. So from your health and wellness to your business or career, your wealth and your sense of fulfillment and joy, how you live and experience your relationships, I help women to become clear on what it is they truly desire in their current season of life, or if they're navigating another season, perhaps a change in their life, business, or career, and they're not quite sure what comes next. I work with them to get exceptionally clear on what that is, to align their desires with their values, and to ensure that any underlying beliefs that they are carrying with them are, again, very much in sync with what they truly desire. And then we go on to map this beautiful strategy or blueprint on how they can essentially bring that design to life. And you asked about my experience in this area. So I have actually spent over 2 decades in the personal and professional development arena, if you call it that. I grew up working with and learning from some incredible icons, what I call the sort of original thought leaders in the space, including Wayne Dyer, Bob Proctor, Tony Robbins, Robin Sharma. My family had a business where we produced and promoted these iconic speakers on our stages across North America and parts of the UAE. And so at a young age of like 18, 19 years old, I was learning from these incredible leaders and authors in the space, and eventually got to work in the business producing the stages that would host them and, you know, help to get their message and their teachings out into the world. So for almost 2 decades, I worked in the business and learned firsthand what it is that people truly desire, what happiness means to them, how they design their wealth, their freedom, and what makes some people learn certain materials and actually integrate it in their life to create meaningful change, and what makes other people simply learn the material but then not do anything with it. And so I became very fascinated with human psychology and human behavior, and it's what's led me to start my own business in this space.
I love it. What are some of the traps and pitfalls that you're plucking people out of and talking to them about doing things with intention? What are those common pitfalls that you're dealing with?
Love this question. So the common pitfalls that I observe, especially in working with women who are in their midlife and who might be wanting to choose something different, is we often deviate to our old patterns. We often go to what's familiar, what's repetitive in our life, and we're most often doing it from a very subconscious layer. And what that means is essentially we are habits, creatures of habit. We tend to do the same things over and over again, but then we expect a different result and wonder why we're not getting that. And so what I try to help my clients do first and foremost, once we have this clarity piece on around what it is they desire, we start to unlock what are some of the patterns that you're repeating over and over again, and how do we start to interrupt those patterns? How do we start to ask better questions that will lead us to a path of new behavior? And then working to instill those new behaviors. So whether that's the narrative that you know, your inner dialogue, how you speak to yourself, or it could be a pattern of just how you're leading your day. You know, if you wake up in the same way every morning and you have the same potentially limiting thoughts or behaviors that you had yesterday, then you're likely going to repeat the same patterns and have the same results. And so one of the main pitfalls we have is just really appreciating and understanding what are the patterns that you're repeating that are getting you the results that you no longer want. How do we interrupt those and instill new behaviors and patterns for you?
I've done some work in the past on myself. Does this fall in line with the concepts of habit stacking, which is a term I've thrown around a little bit, of, you know, figuring out, hey, if I find this thing is successful, then doing a second successful thing at that same time. It's kind of reverse engineering what we usually do, which is, you know, stack one bad habit leading to another bad habit.
Yeah, absolutely. That is certainly one of the tools that we use in the coaching work that I do is how do we instill new habits? How do we instill those new patterns? So a habit is simply a pattern that you've been, you know, you've put into practice and it's become rote. Like you don't even have to think about it anymore. Initially, it doesn't start that way because you have to get in the practice of doing something new. And habit stacking certainly is something that leads to new pattern behaviors. So to give an example, if I were working with someone who has a habit of waking up in the morning and the first thing they do is reach for their phone, jump into their emails, and start thinking about work right off the bat, but what they really desire is more time freedom, less anxiety in their day, I may want to introduce them to a new habit of let's not keep your phone in your room. Let's move that away so that you're not tempted to reach for it because that will be the natural instinct is for you to reach for it. But if we were to move your phone out of your room so that you weren't reaching for it first thing, and we were to introduce some healthy habits of the person who has the thing that you desire. So if you're desiring more time freedom, and you were to embody that person's behavior, what would they do at the beginning of their day to create more time freedom as a habit? And that might be something like, you know, they wake up and give themselves 30 minutes in the morning to exercise, meditate, you know, set intentions for the day, get into an energy of, I want to create an expansive day and start to instill those habits first. And make the reaching for the phone maybe the fifth or sixth thing they do in the day as opposed to being the first thing.
I had a basset hound growing up, Maggie, and she had these adorable ears that were way too big. And she'd flop over them when she would walk. But she was terrible to train. The saying is that a golden retriever, you can give them a task five times and they'll remember it. Basset hounds, you may give them that same instruction 100 times, they may never learn it. My controversial question here is, are we dogs?
The world might be a better place if we were all dogs. We have a dog too, and he's the most loving part of our family for sure. So I would say, no, we're not dogs, but we learn in a way that we are designed as humans to learn. So we have instinctual needs. We have needs that are based on staying away from pain and gaining or moving towards pleasure. And what I learned many, many years ago studying Tony Robbins is that we'll do more to avoid pain than we will to gain pleasure. And so as a result, we unfortunately wait until circumstances are dire before we make a change. We wait to the point where the pain is so unbearable before we make the change. So a simple example would be you're a university student or you're working in your office, you have a big project that's coming due, and you procrastinate until the very last possible moment where you can no longer procrastinate, where the pain of procrastinating is so great that you finally just pull the all-nighter or put in all the hours to get it done. That's a simple example, but a common one. And to answer your question, we learn behaviors based on how we feel in our nervous system and what feels safe to us. So if we are trying to do something new and, you know, we might set a goal for ourselves, we start taking action, we are showing up, we're getting the positive results, so we keep showing up and doing it again. But at some point, there comes a level of success that we may never have encountered before. And so now we feel unsafe. Our nervous system kind of goes into a bit of a fight or flight response where we're going, this isn't familiar. And so, you know, some people call this our internal thermostat. where we now start to shrink a little bit. We start to pull back on the good habits that we've instilled. We start to go back to our old patterns. We may start noticing it in the form of like procrastination or, you know, dimming our light in terms of not putting out the message that we want to put out because we think, oh, if I'm too visible, then that might be something that's bad for me. I might attract, you know, trolls, or I might attract negative attention, and that doesn't feel safe. So in that sense, we're very much like animals. They're not going to venture into something that feels unsafe. They're going to go back to what's familiar. But you can, bit by bit, as you instill new habits and you train your nervous system to feel safe in those new habits, you can adopt those lasting transformational behaviors. But it's a layered approach. It's not just in the doing, it's actually in the becoming of someone who can hold the type of change and success that you desire to have.
I find it interesting the amount of specialization it seems that advice has gone through in the past 5 years because of, I don't know whether it's the recognition or the proper sorting of neurodivergent versus neurotypical brains in people. Because if you went back to those early days, you know, advice just gets applied to everybody. But when you're talking about procrastination, you know, as somebody who was married to somebody who's autistic, and I probably have severe ADHD myself, the reasons that I procrastinate, as I've come to understand and found a handful of neurotypical friends, they don't procrastinate for the same reasons that I seem to, nor the same reasons I don't procrastinate for the same reasons that my autistic leaning wife seems to. So what are some of the lessons that you learned early on from those bulwark people in the industry that have either needed to be shifted or modified to recalculate for that spectrum of neurocognition?
So, you know, I'm not a therapist. Like, I'm not trained in neurodivergence, so I won't speak to that specifically, but I will say that what I've observed in the industry over the years is the level of appreciation, understanding, the level of information that is available to all of us now to learn from has exploded, right? There is no bit of information that's not really available to everyone to learn about the different aspects of us, the different neurodivergence that people may have. And so that access to information is there, which is wonderful. It wasn't always available to everyone, or you had to know really specifically where to look. Like, you needed to know which psychologists or psychiatrists to read, and you had to go to a library to pull out the book, and you had to study it to learn all this information. Today, it's much more available to us, which is incredible. What that also means is that we have a responsibility to share information that we are able to speak to with depth and experience. And I think that the industry has shifted a lot in terms of the level of expertise and experience that's available to everyone. So someone who has very specific, you know, patterns or ADHD will go to someone who is trained as a trained therapist to help them manage that, to help them learn in a way or change behaviors in a way that supports them. Whereas if you were looking at the industry back when I was kind of growing up in it, there were a few dominant voices, but again, they didn't have the level of expertise or perhaps information available to them at that time. And it was more about how you could change your life. It was more about positive psychology, which at that time was relatively new. At that time, you know, psychologists were more focused on what made people do the negative things that they did, why people were unhappy. And then positive psychology became this conversation around how you could shape your life, how you could make better choices. And we started to see more information around neuroscience and quantum healing through people like Deepak Chopra and Bob Proctor. And so I think the industry has shifted significantly with just that access. And now you're seeing experts. I use the term experts very loosely because I don't think anyone is really an expert in anything. There's always more to learn. But I think you're seeing a lot more availability of people, coaches, therapists, mentors, who have access to very specific information that can serve an individual's needs based on where they are.
Personal life, business life, are they the same thing?
It's an interesting question. I think a lot of people like this idea of work-life balance. And so that implies that you see the two as separate, that it's your work life and your personal life. I have come to believe that work-life balance per se is a bit of a myth that we've been sold. And the reason being that, you know, if you looked back many years ago, when people worked mostly in with their hands in factories, on, you know, if you're working in shift work, that sort of thing, you were able to do your work, close out your shift, go home and focus on your family or focus on your personal obligations. And then with, you know, technology that allows us to take our work with us wherever we go, it's really hard to separate those lines. It's not uncommon for you to be working at home in the evening, working on the weekends, thinking about work all the time. And so I don't know that people would necessarily separate the two. Mm-hmm. However, I do believe in work-life harmony. I think you can create harmony between your work and your life. And that's where, you know, some seasons are going to ask that you work a little more. So you're going to spend potentially less time with your family. And I think this is especially true of like founders, people who are entrepreneurs, where some seasons in your business require more of you. And there's some seasons where you have the time freedom or the flexibility to spend more time with your family or, you know, in other areas of your life that are important to you in addition to your business, to your work. So I don't know that I can necessarily say they're two separate things anymore just because of the nature of the work that we do and the way that we work. Yeah. But I do believe that you can create harmony between the two.
Yeah, I just did an interview with a fellow that he hosts small table dinners for successful CEOs to help them not abandon their family, in short, of like being in that role of like, you know, 80-hour weeks. And, you know, he experienced it himself of like missing, you know, his son's, you know, T-ball games and just wondering what I don't even remember what it was that I'd obligated myself, some unknown mysterious meeting, and I missed those moments. So he, you know, works with CEOs and CFOs to like help on the automation side of things to help prevent, you know, that loss. What are some of the things that you end up coaching as far as practice, as far as habits, as far as workflow or process that can help safeguard and value those moments in your life that aren't going to come again?
Yeah, that's an important question. And it's an important thing for us to consider in everything that we invest our time and energy in now, because I've learned personally through some really very personal losses in my own life that, you know, life is not forever. Sometimes when you're young, it can feel long. And then when you, you know, experience grief or loss, you realize how short life can be as well. And so the time that we have is special, and we owe it to ourselves and to the people that we love to be really intentional about where we're spending our time and our energy. And I also grew up in an era where, you know, the work, your work ethic really mattered. And if you weren't working, you know, a full week or long hours or 13-hour days, that somehow said something about your commitment to the company or your job. And now I think the pendulum has swung the other way, where people are starting to realize that no one ever looked back on their deathbed and said, I wish I had spent more time at work. You know, they look back and say, I wish I had spent more time with my kids when they were young. I wish I hadn't missed those soccer games or dance recitals. And so if we know that, if we can kind of future pace ourselves a little bit and then look back and go, well, what do I want to create in the time that I have? That's some of the work that I do with clients, is that we get really clear on what it is you desire, but rarely, when we dig deep, the desires may start off as very like superficial, you know, things like the big house, the fancy cars, the wardrobes, the jewelry, whatever that is. But when we do the next layer in, where we discover what it is that you truly desire underneath all of that, it always comes down to a feeling of being loved, a feeling of being of belonging, of being seen, of doing work that matters, of, you know, of spending time with the people that you love. And then we design a life from that place, because from there you can get very specific on what is your time best spent on. And I do an exercise with some of my clients around the time freedom piece, which is, okay, let's look at your week. Let's do a time audit. So we actually look at, like, where are they spending the most amount of their time every day? And it's such a beautiful reflective exercise, and it's eye-opening, because when you look back, you actually can see it staring at you back on the page. How many hours did you spend, you know, scrolling Instagram? How many hours did you spend, you know, online shopping for things that maybe you didn't need? And how many hours did you spend sleeping or looking after yourself or with your family? And so those pockets of time, you can now decide on, where can you in your business, are you spending time on things that could be done, that could be automated, that free up some time? Are you doing things that could be delegated to someone else? Are you doing things that really aren't moving the needle in your life or your business towards the things that you say you desire? And if that's the case, then are you ready and willing to put them to the side? And that doesn't mean you can never do them. It just means maybe they're not a priority right now. And when you start to take away some of those things, you realize how much additional time you can give yourself back to be in the places that matter most, to spend the time with the people that matter most, and to do the work that has the greatest impact.
So it comes back to that thing you said in your first sentence, intention.
Yes.
I'm curious, what is the deepest struggle that you've worked with someone on and helped them overcome? If you could share it without breaking confidentiality.
Yes, no, I would never state a name. I think, you know, the one that comes to mind right now, because I've helped clients through it, but I also work through it for myself as well, is the struggle to be fully seen, the visibility piece. And when I say fully seen, I don't mean online or, you know, out in the world in terms of social media or speaking on stages, because not everybody desires that kind of visibility. But I mean being fully seen as who you are and what it is you are truly here to do. And so if I go a little deeper than that, if someone has a dream of doing something, whether it's, you know, they're in career and now they dream of starting a business and they want to really carve out this beautiful expression of who they are outside of the career they've been known for. But there's a fear that holds them because, you know, it could be a fear of the financial security or stability that they've built for themselves. And in most cases, someone like that would make sure they have enough of a financial cushion to be able to step out into a business, or they might build it on the side like I did. But the fear of being visible is the fear of, like, you going out and saying to the people that know you as you are, hey, I actually have this other side of me that I want to express, right? Maybe it's as an artist or a creator or a coach or a teacher or whoever, whatever that is. And there's almost a fear of that because the people we know have known us a certain way, and to be able to step into something new can feel really intimidating. And we fear things like judgment, and we fear things like rejection or envy or someone doubting us or thinking that we might fail in it. And so we step back into what we know, not necessarily because it's comfortable for us, because it's rather uncomfortable to stay in something that's familiar when you know you want something different. But it is comfortable for everyone else. And in that, you get to remain safe, but you also get to remain who everybody knows you to be. And you don't have to rock the boat or ruffle any feathers. And I think that's one of the deepest struggles, because most of the women I work with are deeply devoted to the people in their life as well. And they will give up their own sense of voice, ambition, dream, in order to make sure that no one else that they care about is disrupted by anything. And that's probably one of the deepest struggles.
Kind of ties back to kind of a martyr complex of like, you know, this may be inappropriate, but in the movie The Ref from the 90s, you know, he says to his mother-in-law, like, I'm going to get you a cross for Christmas. So every time you feel unappreciated, you can go up and nail yourself to it. But I think there's an aspect of people who, you know, instead of accomplishing something, they take the not accomplishing something as their accomplishment and, you know, kind of hold it over the people in their life. You know, like they get the value out of, you know, not taking the risk of picking up a job. You know, because, oh, I gave up that part of myself. Have you come across like that type of challenge in your consulting? Mm-hmm. Or if you have people who, you know, have family members who tend to be a little bit of a martyr, any advice or thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's so interesting. So I haven't personally worked with anyone where I would say it was like a martyr complex where, or the victim mentality. I haven't come across that personally. What I have come across is women who, well, you know, different types of women, but I can give you one example. And that is, you know, a woman who is perhaps comes from an immigrant family. So I can personally relate to that as well. Is you come from an immigrant family where, you know, your parents have tried to really help you build a beautiful life and give you opportunities that they perhaps didn't have. But the conditioning that we go through as young people is it happens early. You know, we start to observe the world around us. We start to take the lessons given to us from our parents, from our grandparents, from our community, from our friend groups. And they're not necessarily that we're absorbing them consciously, but that we're absorbing them subconsciously. And this is that layer of belief systems, because it's happening at a very young age. We're not aware of it. And we are most susceptible at the young age to be subconsciously, you know, wiring our brains for certain behavior patterns. And so I don't know that anyone wants to necessarily give up the things that they desire. Mm-hmm. I think they do so sometimes out of a sense of obligation, out of responsibility, out of conditioning that they're not even aware is there. And to some extent, out of a feeling of safety. Again, I go back to what our nervous systems are wired for, that safety. So if we feel like, hey, I really want to start, I'm going back to this business idea. It's like, if you want to start a business, but you have this solid career that's providing for your family, and you think, I can't leave that career because it will destabilize the life that we've built. It could potentially put my family in jeopardy. If your nervous system has that, you know, is receiving that, it is going to send you all kinds of signals and invitations to just stay where you are. And so in the coaching that I do with women, it's never, ever about let's take this huge giant leap and change everything at once. It's always about let's get clear on what it is you desire and let's start with one small change. So you know, a lot of people in my industry, you know, you'll hear the term, I just want to burn it all down and start from scratch. I will never advocate for that because the women I work with have built beautiful lives. They've worked really hard. They've sacrificed a lot. They've put themselves out on the line. They've invested in themselves, their families, their teams. And so it's never about changing everything, but it is about taking those small steps forward towards the life that you desire to live. That doesn't mean the life you're living isn't already wonderful. It just means there's always room for evolution and elevation in what it is you desire to experience in this life.
Is there a specific reason or purpose that you work with women as opposed to working with both men and women?
So I shouldn't say I work exclusively with women. I work mainly with women. I have worked with men as well. I have to say, I think I work, you know, the reason I chose to work with women more prominently is because of my own life experience and the things that I've walked through in life as a woman of color. And I just feel like I can share from a more personal place than if I were to work with men. I also feel, coming from having worked in the nonprofit world as well in advancing women's equity in the workplace, that is a spot that's really near and dear in my heart, is to help women to step into their confidence, their personal power, to really own their dreams and to know that that is possible for them. Because so many women have come up in a workplace or, you know, a system where maybe they didn't feel like their voice was heard or that they were given the opportunity to really speak their dreams into existence. And I just feel a special responsibility to help women do that.
What's a question that you wish people would ask you? Because you've got that answer loaded in the back of your brain. You're like, oh, really want them to ask that? Because I've got that unlocked.
I think what I wish people would ask is why designing your life should be your first priority.
Why should designing your life be your first priority, Amira?
Great question, Jeremy. Thank you for asking. Designing your life is not just your first priority, it's your responsibility. And I say that, again, from a place of experience and deeply rooted belief, because I have watched people in my own life, myself included, think that we have this unlimited runway of time. And we leave things to chance. We put out a hope or a wish or a prayer, and we hope that it'll just land, that things will just work out. And if we are not intentionally choosing the life that we want to live, if we're not, and it's not that you can plan everything to a T, but you need to know what it is you truly desire to experience in this lifetime. What matters to you? What do you value? And how do you create a life experience that really shines a light on those values, that allows you to live from that place on a daily basis? Because from there, you get to enjoy this beautiful, expansive, fulfilling, wealthy, peaceful life. And again, if I were to future pace and I recall speaking to people who were ill, who, you know, were not going to get to live the long life that they had hoped for, the regret is that they didn't start sooner. The regret is that they didn't put the effort in, that they didn't dream bigger and at least take the shot. And so if you're on this earth and if you get to wake up each day and open your eyes, then you have a responsibility to design that day, to make it intentional. Don't leave things up for chance. Yes, things are out of our control, but at least if you walk through life with a picture of what it is you want and a plan and a blueprint, and you're intentionally creating those habits, then you have a far greater chance of living the life experience that you truly desire than someone who isn't designing their life.
People want your help in designing your life, their life. How can they connect with you? Do you have a site? Are you doing any speaking engagements? Do you have any webinars or content for them to consume and get back to you?
Yes, I do. I appreciate you asking that. So I do have a website. It's amiravirani.com. You can reach out to me through an email. There's a form on that website that you can submit, and I'll get back to you. We also have Instagram. So the Instagram is at amira.virani. And I am also on LinkedIn, so you can reach out to me there. I actually have quite a few resources available on Instagram, so you can link to a weekly newsletter. I just launched a Substack as well, and I have a masterclass called, there's two actually, one called Visioneering, which is really about casting that vision for yourself, and that's the first step in designing your life. And then I have another one that I just released called Wealth by Design, and it's truly about defining what your wealth is, what your wealth values are, and how to start to manifest the wealth that you desire beyond the bank balance, but to live a truly wealthy life. So those are all different ways that you can reach out. And I also have a podcast called The Designed Life, which I release a new episode every week on Mondays.
Fantastic. I'll make sure that those resources get linked for everybody in the show notes. Thanks for joining me, Amira.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me. I appreciate you.